Hello, it's Anna Perrow and Sophie Little here. We run Soundyard and we are the producers of Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
We're excited to tell you we've been nominated for an award. It's a public vote, so if you'd like to vote for us, well, that would just be amazing. You can head to norfolkartsawards.org.
Look out for Soundyard. We're under the Broadcast and Media Award, and it's such a pleasure putting the show together and listening with you.
So let's join Chris and Matthew on High Ash Farm.
It's early in the morning, very early in the morning, and I've just been sworn at by one of the roebucks here at High Ash Farm. There's a bumblebee as well, although it's still cool and chilly. 1st of April tomorrow, and it's Queen Bumblebee, and she's just going round in the leaf litter, sounding it out, bumbling about. Roebuck, one side of me, and Queen Bumblebee, so Bufftail Bumblebee, looking for somewhere to start her new nest. I've come down to this area of woodland because it's a special time of year. Still lots of leaves on the ground. It's been dry for the last few days, which is a big help out on the farm. Rats allowed to be with me this morning. The general impression on the ground layer was brown a couple of weeks ago with all the leaf litter there, and it's suddenly changed and it's verdant green now with millions of bluebells and a scattering of early purple orchid coming through. Just listening, the dawn course has finished, but Jackdaw's busy searching out for holes above my head in the old trees, coming up to what looks like a moonscape in front of me. And last few nights I've been putting my trail camera down here. It's at the badger set. We have two badger sets at High Ash Farm. And this time of the year, they're really busy. The sows, that's the female badgers, give birth about now, or a little bit earlier. And I'm just walking down this steep hill. It's gravel soil, and there's enormous mounds all the way around me. Some of them with 30, 40, 50 tons of soil outside each of the holes. Just an amazing sight, and so much activity. The ground is pretty well bare all the way around the set. Odd snowdrops just finished flowering, peeked their heads through. Jackdaws going over my head. Enormous Scots pine trees, sweet chestnut trees all around me coming into leaf. And just walking down into the set, this particular set has over 50 entrances in it, and outside, nest coming up to one of the first holes. They're pretty big. I could almost crawl into the holes myself. Around the entrance holes are piles of leaves, some hay that's been brought here by the sow badger, that's the female. And the boars, the males, have been evicted from the set, and they've set up, so to speak, about 200 yards away in some old fox earths that are behind me. So they're not allowed to be here. And something amazing has happened with two of the sows have given birth. There's over 15 badgers here, which I've recorded. They've all got slightly different patterns on them, so you can identify them. And two of the sows have given birth to cubs. I don't know how many cubs, but the signs are all there. The sows come out of the hole just after dusk and take bedding down. They spend most of the time down with the cubs to start with before they go out and feed. And so the cubs have company most of the time and they're suckled. And when they're about 5 to 6 weeks old, that's when the cameras really come into their own. And you can see wonderful footage of young badger cubs. And Rat's just exploring round. He knows now, this time of the year, not to go down the badger set. He's learnt his lesson in the past when I haven't been watching him carefully. He's come back with a rather bloodied nose because sow badgers with cubs are formidable at guarding their set. So, last night, and I've checked the camera already. I got a wonderful video of one of the sow badgers just coming out of the set hole, which was in front of me, and having a sniff round, then turning round and going back in. But before she went back down, she's only just given birth. She must have been giving off some rather nice perfume for the local fox. So she goes back almost down into the set. And remember, it's pitch dark and the camera has illuminated the scene for us. And the fox comes up and very delicately sniffs her bottom. That is a dangerous thing to do. So, because the video only lasts a few seconds, it's just one of those moments that you can capture. And obviously, the fox would be very interested in the smell of another mammal giving birth. But there was no fisticuffs, and so that's good. So, just walking across the top of the set now. It's been here since I was a child, so it's one of the highlights of wildlife. Remember, badgers are mammals, just like us, and they have every right to be here. But they've made this their home, and it is monumental. There are hundreds and hundreds of metres of tunnels. It's like a labyrinth underneath me, and you can judge how much has been removed in terms of tons of soil by the huge piles that are here. And keep this bit private, and there's always cameras here for the safety of the badgers. If anything, anybody comes here, and occasionally I get woken up at night by a roe deer, such as we heard when I started this recording. But occasionally you get a false alarm, but I can get down here pretty quickly if somebody comes down here with not good intentions, because they're protected species here at the farm. And it's just wonderful. I can hear a nuthatch singing way in the background. Early plane going over the top, and Rat's being very well behaved. He's sitting down quite close to me. So there we are, early signs of spring, badger cubs, and the foxes will be giving birth if they haven't already done so as well. So all the mammals are busy giving birth and having mated perhaps last autumn. So wonderful time of year.
Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast with Matthew Gudgeon.
Well, we're off the farm today for Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast. We're having an away day, I think is the correct term here, and we've only gone a few miles, haven't we,
Chris? Yes, 15 minutes by car from High Ash Farm, and we've just arrived at somewhere where I spent a great deal of my childhood. It's at Wheat Fen Nature Reserve. It was the home of Ted Ellis, and Ted worked on High Ash Farm when he was a youngster in about the 1950s, and got to know my father quite well. He was into archaeology back then, Great deal of family history between the two families. Ted was born 1909, same year as my father. Phyllis, his wife, was born 1913, same year as my mother. My mum's second name was also Phyllis. So,
well, Ted Ellis was a renowned broadcaster, radio and TV.
Yes.
He's a legend in Norfolk wildlife circles, and he founded where we are today, the Wheat Fen Nature Reserve.
Yes.
And we're the guests, I've got to say, of two people here who have just handed us life jackets, so I think we're going afloat. Rebecca and Will, hi there.
Hello, thank you for coming. Nothing to worry about with a boat. There's just one small hole in it that takes about 5 hours to get an inch of water. So we're perfectly safe.
That's not reassuring, Rebecca.
Well, you should have heard some of the other boat stories that we've had at Wheat Fen. So, yeah.
Fun and games, as always.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're good at bailing, Chris.
Yes, only putting the tops back on cricket stumps. That's all. That's called bailing.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, let's go down to the river, shall we?
Yes, brilliant.
Now,
right.
This is for people who are looking on their map. And people all around the world listening, the River Yare, which is Norwich out to Yarmouth, isn't
it? Through to Yarmouth, yes. It's a tidal river, but largely fresh water. Of course, with climate change, one of the big concerns is salt surges, which could have drastic effects on fish populations, aquatic invertebrates. But for the moment, water quality reasonably good, and we're going to trundle down the dike system here onto Wheat Fen Broads. And, yeah, hopefully see lots of wildlife.
Well, let's go. There's more water falling from the skies at the moment.
Off we go. Excellent. Yeah, I'm really excited about this. So it's a real thrill and a treat because there's nothing like this at High Ash Farm, only a few miles away. And it just shows you how quickly different habitats change. So we're sort of on the edge of Broadland here, to give you an idea. The Norfolk Broads, hand-dug for peat centuries ago. And now it's just a magical environment.
Well, we're on a walkway here, Chris, and there's the pontoon that we're going to get aboard shortly, and there's some classic Broadland scene here, reed beds.
Yes, there's reed beds here. I love to look in the distance at the woodland as well, which, given half a chance, would cover this old reed bed. That's called Alder Carr. I think it's Britain's only native conifer that isn't an evergreen, because the larch, which is a deciduous conifer, that's an introduced species, but alder produces cones, and it's a terrific favourite for birds like redpoll and siskin as well, eat the seeds, and if they don't get eaten, they blow out into these reed beds, and that's what conservation is all about, which happens here at Wheat Fen. To kind of stop the alder carr taking it all over. But that's all the natural succession of wetland habitats.
So, Rebecca, some management is needed, isn't it, to make wildlife thrive?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if we didn't manage this site, as Chris said, it wouldn't be the reed bed. We wouldn't have our swallowtails, we wouldn't have our sedge warblers, we wouldn't have all of the habitats that we currently have now. It would be either alder carr or, in some cases on our reserve, willow carr. So, yeah.
Well, I can see some bird life already on this very wet and overcast day, but we're next to one of the dikes here which leads to the river. And Will, I presume this is our transport here.
This is indeed. This is our trusty metal work boat, and well, we use it for all sorts of jobs. Recently we've been ferrying lots of boardwalk materials round via Rockland Broad along the river up to our northern side of the reserve. Access on the footpaths is very wet at the moment, so it's handy to have a solid boat to get stuff round.
Where's the roof?
We're hardly Norfolk souls, we're all right.
I should think so.
Speak for yourself.
Put some colour in your cheeks, Matthew.
Sturdy vessel. We've got oars just.
We've got oars,
so
right?
Safe,
excellent.
If the
yes.
Fails.
Yes. So it's swim or drown. Yes.
You come from a seafaring family, though, don't you?
I do. I've got Horatio Nelson, believe it or not, Norfolk's sort of wizard man, if you like, for sailing, and he's a distant relation, and it comes down from my mum's side. So, yeah, so a bit of history. So as soon as I'm on a boat, I'm over the side, calling for my best friends, probably.
Rebecca's on board now, and I think it's your turn, Chris.
Right. In we go.
Find your head on the bar.
In goes Chris. and I'll duck under the bar here and onto the pontoon, and here we are on board. There's a little outboard motor and a couple of paddles as well, Chris.
Ramming speed. And look at the dike, Matthew. It's dead straight ahead of us, obviously man-made, and the reeds sort of bending over the water, and it's typical Broadland sea. And this is, I think, how you should be seeing it. With the rain, it kind of typifies what was Ted Ellis's home, and so he's be quite used to this.
So he was quite a visionary, really, and someone who was so keen on conservation years before it was fashionable.
Absolutely. He is one of those people that inspired so many others. I'm one of those people, which is why I do the podcast today. And lots of other people were inspired equally. And it was the place to go on a Saturday morning. The local press, the Eastern Daily Press, had a little column done by Ted. Phyllis used to read it down the phone to a Mr. Saltmarsh at the Eastern Daily Press office. And she would read Ted's diction for the week down there. And it would appear on the Saturday morning down Nature's Byways with EAE. And it was the place I always went to first in the Saturday paper. There we are.
Well, Ted Ellis had the vision of this piece of property next to the river and restoring it, really, didn't he?
Yes.
Which was the name of his particular aim and ambition.
It seems counterintuitive to be cutting down willow and alder in order to maintain the reed beds, but then you've got the diversity of species which Rebecca has told us about. And just congratulations to him and to the team, which mainly volunteers look after this setup. Fantastic. Right, I think we're ready to go, are we?
Yeah, I'm just going to show you. Just here is the first cuckoo flower, nearly open.
Yes.
With climate change, it is slightly earlier. It's meant to coincide with the arrival of the cuckoo, the bird itself.
Yes, and meadow sweet, just on the corner.
Bit of meadow sweet and valerian, all grown out of that little island from the jetty. Like a little ecosystem.
Oh, lovely.
It's also the food plant for the orange tip butterfly, the cuckoo flower. So we'll be seeing little orange orbs on there within a few weeks.
Yep. Garlic mustard as well is the other food plant. Brilliant. That's even before we get moving, so there's just know how to look and where to look. And yes, come on, let's go.
And we're underway. What sort of bird life are we expecting to see this afternoon, do you think, Rebecca?
Oh, well, we've got the chiff-chaffs. They've now started moving in, and black caps as well. One of our volunteers just yesterday saw our first swallow of the year. So I don't know if we'll see them today, maybe not in the rain. Recently, over the last few weeks, our skies have just been filled to the brim with the calls and sky dances of marsh harriers. So we've been able to watch those, me and Will, as we've been sorting out all of our dredging work that has happened this winter.
And the marsh harriers will hunt low over this land?
Yes, yeah. So they'll probably be like gliding up in the sky and then just zoom down over the reed bed if they've seen something, making like their mating calls at the moment, which is quite nice to hear because over the winter they've been quite silent, and now you can start to hear them with their vocal calls. They're kind of a bit like a cat almost, some people might say.
They've made quite a comeback, haven't they, Chris, the marsh harrier?
Yes, really good, because if you have the habitat for a particular creature or bird, insect, small mammal, then the whole kind of ecosystem puts itself back in. That's what you call biodiversity, where you have a whole selection of different species feeding all down the food chain. I suppose top of the predator list here would be an otter that's on the fish, and if you've got swan mussels in the riverbed, it will take those out. And obviously the avian predators, things like the marsh harrier, occasionally sparrowhawks, I suppose, Rebecca, come through.
Definitely in the woodland. Quite often you can see them in the woodland near we don't have feeders at the moment, but in the past around some feeders, they kind of like sit and hide and wait and then zoom out. So yeah, definitely in the woods, for sure, we'll have the sparrowhawk.
And Chris mentioned otter. Otters,
yes.
Do you see many of them here?
Yes, yeah, we do. So, yeah, they often like come in all of our dikes, all the way around our reserve. We normally see them in us with the a good sign of them is us the sprait that they leave behind, which has like a rosemary smell, and you can look through that and see all the fish that they've been eating. A few weeks ago I actually saw one in our pond, and it walked right in front of me about a meter away from me and went and hid under our hide, the thatch. So yeah,
well, that's quite a thrill, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, otters are coming back to some degree, but still rare.
Yes, they are. We have them at the farm. We've created a water habitat, and last year I managed to have the video, the trail cam on the edge of the area of water, and I got the otter, the female, with three cubs playing. Oh, that was just delightful to see. But quick question, has Will been on the beer at lunchtime? Did you notice we just went into the bank just then?
He can't hear us because of the engine. It's very windy and very wet, and this channel is about 10 foot wide, maybe a bit more. And it's leading into another channel, which eventually, I suppose, goes into the River Yare. But this is so important, this sort of habitat, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So we're now coming up to our, we call it the Fen Channel. It's the kind of the main channel that runs through Wheat Fen. So if we go to the left, we'll come up to our Penguin Dyke, which is named that because there was a penguin wherry that was stationed there during the war, which got bombed, apparently. And that's why it's called Penguin Dyke. And we're going to head now into our Wheat Fen Broad, which eventually going through there and then into Rockland Broad, we'll get to the Yare. Yeah, this is an amazing habitat. It's absolutely great that we can have such amazing waterways at Wheat Fen. We've seen lots of fish in there recently, like roach and rudd and perch. Last year there was thick-lipped grey mullet in there. And there's always teal and gudgeon.
Gudgeon?
Yes.
There's a surprise. Well, do you know what? I was just thinking as we've gone through this, we're only a few miles from the city of Norwich, and looking where we are now, it just feels like we could be anywhere in the world. It's just another world, isn't it? It's beautiful. Absolutely stunning.
Yeah, that's one of the things that so many visitors say about Wheat Fen, that they just describe it as a complete magical wilderness. You're so close to nature. It's like Chris said, it's hard to believe that we're so close to Norwich. It does not feel like that at all. It does feel like you could be anywhere else in the world away from an urban environment. It is truly magical at Wheat Fen, for sure.
This weather isn't, though. It is really blowing a hooly and very wet indeed, Chris.
It is. The boat's
the
having...
things a, you get me into.
The boat's having a job to head into the wind. But look at this. We're just coming onto the Broad now. Surlingham Broad here.
And two mute swans.
And beautiful. Right beside us, a cob and a pen.
Well, Chris, here we are on quite a small body of water, but it's the classic broad sort of environment, isn't
yes, it? Yes, this is about a hectare, I suppose, in size, about 2.5 acres of water. But you have the feeling that it's much bigger because it's open habitat around the water. And remember, the water actually goes into the reed beds as well, so the water area is much bigger. Perfect for water voles, sedge warblers, reed warblers. You've got a whole variety of habitats in one. In fact, there's more biodiversity here than there is in prime agricultural high ash farm, which has looked after poor wildlife. But I thought the wind was blowing so strongly just then, it'd have been quicker for me to get out and walk. But how deep's the water, Rebecca, here?
Well, we're now coming up to the deepest part of the Broad, called Deep Waters. That's about 18 foot deep there. So recently, a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the Broad that we're currently on was completely dredged. Will might know the facts in terms of how much mud got pumped out.
We're talking about the dredging, Will, here. How much mud was taken out?
In the two Broads here, it was 6,000 cubic metres of silt pumped out. That was through 30 years of succession. Unfortunately, a lot of it is agricultural runoff. It's topsoil. It's getting washed down with various ploughing techniques that, honestly, us, the farmers, any favours. They want their topsoil. They want their nutrients. And again, it's a succession. If we left it, this Broad would eventually be hover, which is
quite a dicey habitat to walk across the whole world. Feels like it's moving up and down. And then reed beds, and then car woodland again. We've got a grant from Natural England under our stewardship scheme to pump the Broads to maintain this wonderful habitat, where we go. Hope you might see some kingfishers and otters just around the corner.
Well, I'd love to see a kingfisher. It'd be a splash of colour. And I suppose the point is, Chris, we've gone from extremes, haven't we? We've had one of the worst droughts on record, followed by that very wet period.
Yes, it played havoc with the farm and farming right across the east of England, and particularly down in the southern part of the UK, the Somerset Levels, and indeed, more locally, the Fen District. And fens were areas like this. They were completely disvalued centuries ago, but it was only because of what a group of people called the Fen Tigers, who managed the fens for sedge cutting and reed cutting, and of course the Broads were dug for peat as well. But when all this dies down, Matthew, each year, it forms a kind of muddy layer, shallow to start with, and then the water, the soil level, if you like, just builds up gradually, and you lose the whole open water areas, which are fantastic for some of our birds which spend their life in or near the water, and that'd be kingfishers and birds like that.
And we're just coming out to a larger body of water now, with the rain still coming down.
Yes.
A reminder that this week's Chris Skinner podcast is coming to you from the Norfolk Broads. We're only a few miles outside Norwich, but it's a lovely place, this. It's the Wheat Fen Nature Reserve, with so much bird life, insect life, and other species as well, wild flowers to enjoy. And we'll give you details about how you can visit here a little bit later on. But let's carry on with our journey.
The willow is producing its pollen at the moment, Matthew. There's some bright yellow, sort of what some people call goat willow, but there's lots of different species of willow in the UK. And it's got its feet right in the water and producing pollen. And the pollen, because it comes into flower so early with that nutritious pollen, is fantastic for our overwintered bumblebees, the queen bumbles, which come out now. And Rebecca has made me incredibly jealous already, because she's seen the first swallow. So we start having the insects flying about, and that brings in the migratory birds as well to feed on the insects, things like chiff-chaff, which I've just heard one at the farm, but I've yet to see my first swallow of the year.
As we're nearly in April now, Chris, we're getting greenery now, aren't we?
Yes,
the seasons are turning.
Yes, the old willow here leaning right over the water nearly closed the dike in front of us. It just looks equatorial, as though we're in somewhere like Senegal.
Like a mangrove swamp.
Exactly what it looks like.
You don't have black mambas here, do you?
Well, we've got grass snakes, but no, not black mambas.
That's the important thing, isn't it, to say that actually amphibians are thriving, but also reptiles as well. We've got our own homegrown versions of these rather exotic creatures.
So me and Will had a really lovely experience along Home Dyke just the other day. We saw our first grass snake swimming through Home Dyke. So yeah, you'd think that our reptiles maybe don't go in the water, but they do. So we have our grass snakes here. They're they're the UK's only snake that actually lays eggs. All the other snakes are live bearing. So. Yeah.
Magpie's nest there in the willow. Is that magpie nest, Will?
It doesn't look like it.
Not far above the water, but well protected by all this.
Yes, it's round, so that's what I guess. They're guilty because they build like all crow species, build a flat nest, but magpies put a dome over the top of it to protect their eggs. Very clever.
We often talk about the encroachment of roads and building of homes that is compartmentalising the countryside.
It is. That's why places like Wheat Fen and many of the places managed by the Norfolk Wildlife Trust as well, they're absolutely crucial. And it puts people in touch with nature, and that's missing in so many people's lives today. And already, since we've been here, my mood has completely changed. I feel very relaxed. I feel it's like a second home, and yet it's something that most people have never seen. So that's why it's important to save these places because they do alter without management. They can change in a decade, 10 years. This would be unrecognisable unless it's managed properly. So the work done by Weekfend, the volunteers here, is absolutely crucial. But it's just another world. And it's only, as I said, minutes from the city.
But all joking aside, apart from the weather, this is a real privilege seeing this today because it's not really accessible and it wouldn't be practical for lots of people to come here and see it from the water. So what we're seeing here today is a very secluded spot, isn't it?
Yes, this is. I mean, I've never actually been round here and I've been working here for 6 months. So yeah, very lucky that we're coming round this part of the reserve.
And the reeds are all growing out of the channel here, so we're coming through this here. And
yes, the seeds off the reeds are an important food as well for the reed buntings. There's lesser bulrush here, or reed mace, growing out of the water. And Matthew, we've almost come to a stop because we've got reeds under the boat. I think it's Rebecca's going to get an oar and I'm going to pick an oar up this side. So we hope we'll get out for the weekend. Oh, we're away now.
Chris is paddling his own canoe. You've done that before, haven't you?
Oh yes, yeah. And can you see the alder in the background, which would love to take this over? You can see it's got a black impression when you look at it, and they're the cones still on the trees. So it's perfect seed source for those birds I mentioned, redpoll, which are small brownish birds, but with a pink top on the head, particularly this time of the year with the male. And then a siskin as well, looks rather like a smaller version of a greenfinch. But a pair of moot swans in front. So we might need the oars for a completely different reason in a minute.
They look quite chilled to me, yes, those swans. So. Chris, the kingfisher. And really the name says it all, they're expert fishermen, aren't they?
Yes, and Ted, in his journals and his writings that he did from about the age of 10, kingfisher often featured in those, and he brought them to light in a really special way, just recording that instant flash that you get as it goes down the river, sometimes with a minnow going back to feed a female on the nest, but generally they quickly dive into the water on a waterside perch, into the water, and come up with a minnow, or dare I say a small gudgeon, and they swallow it head first. So just fantastic to see.
Pike. Me, that's a quintessential Broads.
Of course.
A very exciting species.
Absolutely, yes. It used to petrify me as a youngster. I spent my entire childhood, if not walking about bird nesting, I was fishing beside the River Tass and pike would be lurking in the shallows on the edge and suddenly they'd explode, go through the water and catch a dace or a small roach.
Well, it's so pleasant, even on a rather wet day, to be here on the Norfolk Broads, yes, and not in the middle of a large broad, as you may do when you're on holiday or on one of the rivers, but on one of the side tributaries and in amongst the reeds and, yes, seeing the real Broadland.
Absolutely, and the water level comes up and down here depending on the tide back at Yarmouth or Yarmouth, because we're right next to the River Yare and it's Yarmouth, the mouth of the River Yare, only a few miles away. And we're close to sea level here, which is why the water goes up and down. There's very little fall from here to the North Sea, so the water is static a lot of the time. But the reed beds just fascinate me. It's just a completely different feel in the environment to the one I'm used to, with the black alder trees in the distance there, silhouetted against the grey sky. It's just symbolic of Broadland and the bit that Ted fell in love with and captivated him for the rest of his life.
Well, there's the long straight channel back to the Staithe, and that's the way we're heading now. So let's carry on enjoying this Broadland scene.
Beautiful.
just gone past a clearing in the reeds here, Chris, and that's an important part of the management, isn't it?
Absolutely. Of course, it was all done as part of people's living years ago. Many of the houses around the Broadland area are thatched. In fact, some of Norfolk's churches are thatched as well, and they would use these species of reed cut much earlier in the year after they'd finished growing for them. This year's growth is coming through, and having clear patches like that is perfect for small mammals, and it also allows a fresh crop of reed to come through, because people earned their living from it years ago, centuries ago. It was so important. And then earlier than that, of course, peat would have gone into Norwich for burning on the fires over winter. It was dug out in July and August. How you could do that now with the water level this high, I don't know, in the Broads. So they must have dried out in the summer months. Then it was stored and dried and sold as fuel. And that's what kept these marshmen, who Ted loved. He said he learnt as much from the marshmen and the people that worked and the cattle herders that he did from going into university and talking to the big boffins, he called them.
And there was dear old Eric Edwards, wasn't there, over yes. at Howe Hill. And there's a chap, Wally, who's down at Chedgrave, that sort of way, I think.
Yes. They were fantastic people. They worked with the seasons, and their knowledge was incredible. And it was founded on hard work and observation. And that's what Ted Ellis loved.
Well, we're coming up to the mooring point here. And, Will, you saw a kingfisher earlier today, not for me, sadly, but another thing I was looking out for maybe was evidence of water rats.
Yes, we're very lucky.
You have them here, do you?
We do, and very recently there's been papers published to say the mink has been eradicated from Norfolk, which is a North American species, sadly released in the Broads, and they decimated the water vole stocks. Now the water voles are thriving, they've come back, and we regularly see them swim in the dikes. Interestingly, the other day we watched a stoat swimming up this dike here, chasing the water voles, which is more of a natural predation. Obviously, natural predation is fine, there's a balance there, but when these invasives are released, they do a lot of damage, and thankfully the mink has been eradicated.
Do you see your crew here, Rebecca and Chris? They're getting us moored in. There's a fair amount of water in the bottom of this vessel. I did say
there's a slow leak. I wasn't joking.
Chris, you're holding on to the dry land there.
Yes, I'm a bit uncertain about your sea legs, Matthew. Yes. Anyway.
Well, I've got to say, Will, that was absolutely terrific. We really enjoyed that, didn't we?
Absolutely, yes. Just another world, and I've got a huge smile on my face, and just I can't explain it. It just gives you a very special feeling inside to leave the busy world behind. I'm close to the city, of course, and it's just another world here.
The Norfolk Broads, Broadland, and there are a lot of opportunities to see wildlife, but this is one of the most special. It was Ted Ellis's vision, the great broadcaster and writer, great naturalist, and Will, people can come visit here all the year round, can't they?
Yes, we open 7 days a week, sunrise until sunset, and there's no charge. Of course, we love a donation, always very welcome, but I think we're quite unique. We don't charge. In the spirit of Ted's legacy, everyone is welcome.
And you have volunteers as well, don't you?
Yes, we rely very heavily on the volunteers. I can't take much credit. They do phenomenal amounts of work, and we have 40 plus volunteers, all ages and backgrounds. Some have been coming here longer than I've been alive, helping out with the fed management. They also undertake ecological surveys, they help out with events, and we couldn't run without them.
It's Wheat Fen. You'll find it at Surlingham, which is a few miles to the east of Norwich. And Chris, how am I going to get out of this thing?
Well, I think you could become a volunteer, Matthew. I've heard you're ace with a scythe.
Even operate my lawnmower, let alone a scythe.
Thank you, Will. That was inspirational.
Thank you, Rebecca.
That's okay. Thank you. It's been lovely to have you guys here. And just, everyone come to Wheat Fen, because it is magical. It's truly, truly magical here. It's a special place.
Even in the rain.
Right, we're into this week's bumper post bag. Goodness me, have we got some questions to ask? Matthew's had to leave us temporarily. He's got wet trousers, but we won't go to... We both are absolutely soaked after our boat trip. But anyway, here I am with some of this week's questions. The first one is from Melanie Griffiths, and she lives in Alderney. She's got quite a large pond in her garden, and last year, around about mid-April, it turned bright pink, and she was a little bit worried about it. It looked like a scum over the top of the water, but it isn't. It is doing the same thing this year, and she sent me a wonderful photograph of the pond, and it's a water fern that you've got growing on the top. If you pulled one of the little sort of pinkish plants up, you'd find long roots just going down into the water, not into the soil or the mud underneath at the bottom of the lake. And it's called Azuola folliculares. But fortunately for us, it's got a common name. It's called flamingo weed. And there you are. That's what you've got. And it's brilliant because you've got a very up-to-date pink pond in your garden, so well done. Next question is from Melanie Bannum. Good morning, she says. When my father died 18 years ago, this piece of wood was going to be put out. I saved it because I wanted to know what it was used for. I was just wondering if Oracle Chris, I've been called other things, I can promise you, might know. I love the podcast and have my Sunday breakfast with Chris and Matthew every week. Thank you. You are so lucky because I have found the very piece of wood. The machine's called a Smythe Suffolk Corn and Manure Drill, and it's made by Ransoms, and it's from about 1840 to 1909. It was horse-drawn. And illustrated, the picture I've sent off is the hopper of the drill is open, and there's a vertical seed selector's wheel, and you can change the speed because it's land wheel driven, and so it's a variable seed rate. The front hopper is for fertilizer and contains a plate, which is horizontal, and a flicker, which is vertical, just over the plate. Your wood is a flicker. It's one of three sets supplied with the drill, holding different number of pegs to vary the rate. It's made of elm wood, and it's beautifully made. So thank you for that. And what about that? Solved that mystery. Next one's from Johnny in Norwich. Listening to last week's podcast on counting hares, with the hares sprinting away as you frantically attempted to count them, got me wondering about the speed of wildlife on the farm. What are the fastest animals? What are their top speeds? And why have they evolved to be so fast? And does Rat the Terrier, my terrible rat, feature in the top fastest animals on the farm? Well, he thinks he's pretty quick, which is really amusing. But without doubt, the fastest animal would be the peregrine falcon, which nest on Norwich Cathedral. They've got incredible eyesight, and their favourite meal is to come out to High Ash Farm, which is just a moment flight away. It's within sight. The farm's within sight of Norwich Cathedral, and wood pigeons. And when they stoop to catch a pigeon, it's the fastest bird that you could ever imagine to see. And every animal has a really fast speed depending on its size. Bumblebees, for example, fly off at a huge rate of knots. Their wing beat is about 120 wing beats, wait for it, a second. Honeybees, 240 wing beats a second. Just unbelievable, the speed that which some of the creatures that live in nature use to get about, or in their wing speeds, for instance. And there's even a species of gnat, which is absolutely incredible. I've recorded it, and they land on leaves, and they start drumming, and they create a vibration, and it's just over 1,000 wing beats a second, and they're probably the fastest. And, of course, we talked about the hares sprinting away, and hares can go up to about 35 miles an hour, but generally they do that because they have to get away with predators, and really the only predator for hares, once they're adults, are humans, really. So there we are. And Rat would love to be in this list, but he hasn't qualified. Right, next question is from Claire Dimon. Hi, Chris. I look forward to listening to your podcast every week. I just thought I would comment on the question from a listener this week about nest box protection. I had a similar experience when I had a great spotted woodpecker enlarge the entrance hole of my blue tit nest box and predated the babies inside, which was very distressing. So I found a 3-inch square metal plate with the right size hole already cut, screwed it onto the front of the blue tit box. Then the woodpecker tried to enlarge the ventilation holes at the side of the box, so I cut out a plate from an old biscuit tin and screwed that onto the box. I hope the new blue tit family can now be raised in peace. Stay well and best wishes, Claire. Right, thank you for that. It's a good idea, and I suggested a very large diameter washer with just the right size hole in it, depending on the bird species, using the nest box. Next question's from Ian Smith. And it says, I have been interested in trees all my life, since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. This week you mentioned flowers on trees. I was interested in the tulip tree and always thought it was its name due to the shape of its leaves until last year when I saw it in flower while in Uzbekistan. Does it flower in the UK? And the answer is yes, it does. You need a good hot summer like we had last year. It's an introduced species, so it's not a British native. It was called poplar tree when it was first introduced, and if you look at the leaves, they're like maple leaves. They've got four very distinct points on the leaves, and it can get to, what, 35 metres tall, which is well over 100 feet, and it's called a tulip tree because of the shape of the flowers. Very, very exotic when you see them in full flower. Good. Yet another question. Goodness me. It's from Stephen Alger. Morning, Chris and Matthew. Spring has officially sprung in Acol, as today I heard my first chiff-chaff of the year. There we are. And I've heard them as well, but I'm waiting on tent hooks for the first swallows to arrive at any moment at High Ash Farm, usually about the first week in April. So the week ahead, I'm going down to the old stables every night with a torch and seeing who's come first.
This is a Soundyard production. Music is by Tom Harris.